Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, channel the New Book. Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, channel the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Zachary Lechner to discuss his book, The South of the Mind. Dr. Lechner looks at how Southern whiteness was imagined, portrayed, and discussed between 1960 and 1980 in the United States. He argues that certain narratives about Southern whiteness became increasingly attractive around the country, partly as a way to move past the racial traumas of the 1960s, but also to try to restore white American masculinity at a time when it seemed uniquely threatened.
Dr. Lechner, welcome to the New Books Network. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm an assistant professor of history at Thomas Nelson Community College in Hampton, Virginia, and I've taught in a few different places. Prior to that, I taught full-time at a kind of magnet high school, elite high school in Durham, North Carolina. And then I did the adjunct route for several years while I was working on my PhD. But I did receive my PhD from Temple University in Philadelphia. I took my MA at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. And if we want to go all the way back to undergraduate, I took an undergraduate degree at Truman State University in Northeast Missouri.
And what led you to this project, which is South of the Mind?
I was someone who was always fascinated by the American Civil War. You know, so I was probably part of that generation of young people raised on Ken Burns. Watched the Civil War with great interest and watched it many times afterwards. And as I got into academia, as I got into grad school, I kind of thought, even at that time, the Civil War, wow, that's a topic that a lot of people write on, and that's a really, really crowded field. So of course I moved into post-World War II 20th century history and then totally got rid of that, that problem, of course. But in reality, I realized I didn't really necessarily want to study the Civil War, but I was very interested in the South. Mm-hmm. And then as I got into taking classes at Purdue University, particularly with Nancy Gaben, who later became my advisor, I realized that, you can write about popular culture. You can do that. I didn't really realize that was a thing until I got into graduate school. And so I guess this project kind of came out of a desire to combine both of those interests, like an interest in the history of the South and an interest in popular culture, film, music, television, books, et cetera. So it's really just kind of a Frankensteining together of interests that's led me to this project.
And what was the research process like for this? I mean, I'm assuming it wasn't just sitting around watching Andy Griffith and listening to the Allman Brothers.
Well, there was that. There was that. And it's always nice, to if there's any, you know, graduate, you know, well, I know there's many graduate students listening, but it's always nice, you know, if you can use research money to buy CDs, you know, because that's obviously something that's will be helpful for the project. And then, you know, you don't have to give those back at the end. So Temple didn't ask for all my Leonard Skinner records. So, yeah, I mean, it was some of that. I mean, it was, you know, watching Andy Griffith, the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, watching films and, you know, taking, you know, notes on films. You know, it was also just a lot of just kind of traditional type research, you know, so looking at a lot of popular magazines, you know, going through, you know, the starting, you know, like with the New York Times and, you know, what are they saying about the South, you know, and that was kind of a difficult thing because, first of all, South as a search term is a little bit problematic. Southernness as a search term is kind of non-existent. And so sometimes I felt like when I was doing the research that, you know, I was trying to find a South that was both kind of everywhere and nowhere at the same time. So I was looking at, you know, traditional sources, popular culture sources, traditional printed sources, popular culture sources. And then also I did some archival research as well. So I spent some time both at the Jimmy Carter Library in Atlanta and at the Gerald Ford Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I did research for my chapter on the 1976 campaign, and particularly the role of Carter's Southernness in that campaign, how he tried to use it as a, you know, as a strategy to help him appeal to voters. And that was definitely a challenge, you know, trying to figure out to what extent, say, just in that instance, you know, Southernness did affect the campaign, because I think, you know, there was a lot of anti-Southern bias against Carter, but it was often under the surface, you know, and, you know, it was difficult to try to tease out from the historical record sometimes. So you just kind of had to, you know, look at a lot of, cast your net broadly and look at a lot of different stuff and, you know, end up wasting your time on, you know, in a lot of material that you ended up not using. But you know, that happens with every project. So, it was just a unique challenge though, of trying to identify something, you know, Southernness that is kind of somewhat, I don't know, some nebulous, I guess, like it's kind of hard to kind of put your finger on sometimes. I just had to work through that, and it's probably why it took me a long time to finally complete the project. Cause it was a long search.
So for somebody unfamiliar with this particular subject, how would you describe, what your argument is in South of the Mind?
Well, I argue that the South, in particular the white South, not always, but very often in a kind of rural incarnation, served as a unlikely savior, really, in the minds of a number of Americans, not just Southerners, but non-Southerners as well, and a savior from really the, just generally speaking, the anxieties and the difficulties of 1960s and 1970s America. And so these difficulties, these problems there's a whole host of them. And, you know, as many of your listeners will know this already, you know, so, you know, discord, relating to race, discord relating to the Vietnam War, you know, concerns about, consumer culture, you know, kind of sapping the brains of America's youth, the malaise of suburbanization, conformity, right? In general, the problems can be classified under a term that the pop sociologist Vance Packard used in a 1972 book called The Nation of Strangers, in which he kind of, you know, posited that Americans were kind of losing connection with each other. And that word is rootlessness. So in a sense, there's this fear of, the overriding fear of rootlessness in 1960s, 1970s America, that the white South, which is generally presented as, or often presented as a bulwark of traditionalism, and stability, and, you know, familialism, to use the word that's invoked by the creator of the rural Southern TV sitcom The Waltons, that, you know, that the white South is this kind of this savior, it's gonna you know, bring the nation out of its funk. Now, obviously, I don't know if on a conscious level people, you know, necessarily are thinking like, okay, well, if I just, you know, listen to enough Allman Brothers records, you know, and if I just vote for Jimmy Carter, that, you know, that the Southernness will wash over me and everything will be fine in the nation. I mean, that's not, I think, a thought that people have. But underneath the embrace of all of these kind of aspects of white Southernness and kind of positive imaginings of white Southernness, there is definitely that inclination, the sense that the white South has somehow preserved something that other Americans have abandoned. And so if we kind of concentrate, if we kind of focus on what the white South is doing, whether it be issues related to even race, which might be kind of surprising to us, or issues related to, you know, how people connect with one another in terms of like their family relations or their connection to the land, that, you know, that there seems to be kind of a potential for the white South providing an avenue out of these myriad of difficulties that Americans are trying to sort out in the 60s and the 70s. Are there actual solutions for these problems, or really clearly discernible solutions that can be arrived at? Maybe not. And so the South of the Mind, though, functions as a kind of a fantasy of Americans seeing themselves out of these otherwise kind of insoluble problems.
So your first chapter, you get to look at some interesting materials, but you're also laying the groundwork of frameworks of understanding the South, sort of different Southern narratives that emerge in the early 1960s. What are you looking at here?
Well, there's three main narratives that as you referenced there. One is the vicious South, one is the changing South, and three is the down-home South. So these are not necessarily terms that are being used at the time. These are terms of my own creation, you know, with the hopes that someday people who are smarter than me will use them, you know, and act like they're actual real things, you know. But you know how that goes. But they are real in the sense that they capture, you know, something very true about the varied and often very diametrically opposed views of the South. And I'm focusing here really on, in the first chapter, on the 1960s civil rights movement. Okay, civil rights movement era. Okay, so it's not just a chapter about the movement, but about kind of the era in which civil rights is kind of at its peak, particularly the Black civil rights movement is really what I'm focused on in the South. So the vicious South, this is in some ways kind of the most familiar of the narratives about the South. So this is a concept that says the South, and in generally meaning the white South, is a uniquely bigoted, you know, racist place, just unapologetically so. It is everything that the rest of America is not. Okay, it is the worst of America. So the vicious South functions really as the American other. You know, they're kind of the ugly redheaded stepchild of American society. You know, so it's like we're everything that's wrong with America, you know, has its own special place to go to, and that place is the South. Okay, and it's embodied in the behavior of white Southerners. And how do we know that? Well, just look at the evidence. You know, look at those snarling people outside of Southern schools as dignified African American children are trying to just get past them and become educated in an integrated setting. And so you see this version of the South, the vicious South. You see it in newspapers. You see it in television news reports. You see it in publications like John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. Okay, part of Travels with Charlie, this is, by the way, is a nonfiction travelogue that's published by Steinbeck in 1962, in which he describes his journey in search of America, as it says in the tagline of the book. And at the end of his journey, he ventures through the South. And, you know, if he was looking for America, or what he hoped America would be, he definitely did not find it in the South, because he arrived in New Orleans right at the time of this desegregation drama, in which you had a group of kind of this infamous group of white women known as the cheerleaders, standing outside of of this New Orleans school and yelling and terrifying little black kids as they're trying to enter the school. Oh, did we drop out again?
Yeah, actually, you keep going and recording. I'm getting called away by an emergency real fast. So
okay.
You just keep talking. You finish out chapter one. I'm going to chop the part where I interrupt you. Okay. And there might be a little bit of silence. Sit tight. I should be back quick, okay?
Okay, no problem. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, another place that the Vicious South narrative is present, and even more famously and even more widely read, is in Travels with Charlie, rather than in Travels with Charlie, is with and in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. So this is a book that Zeb, okay, cut this part out because I messed up. Yeah. In the To Kill a Mockingbird is not part of the Vicious South. So that's an encapsulation of the Vicious South. Now, another aspect or another narrative that's being told about the South or the White South during the Civil Rights era is that of the Changing South. Okay, this is a hopeful narrative. Okay, so this says, all right, the South, it has racial troubles, it has racial problems, and it's, you know, the fault of white Southerners, okay? And of course, there is a lot of truth to these narratives. And I don't mean to say, oh, well, you know, the Vicious South was portraying a white Southerner just really unfairly. I mean, you know, just as a bunch of racists. It's like, well, there were a lot of racists in the South, and they, you know, did a lot of terrible things. And so there obviously is truth to all of these images. It's just the way that they're deployed and the way that the way that they're utilized that makes them meaningful. So with the Changing South, there's also some truth to it. There's this idea that the South is in transition. So the South has racial problems. Okay? Bigoted white Southerners are, you know, in need of change, but there are glimmers of hope that they may be already changing, that the South may be already on its way to rehabilitating itself in terms of its race relations. Okay, so this Changing South is really primarily a story of a white awakening. And that awakening or that Changing South is most visible in Harper Lee's book, To Kill a Mockingbird. It comes out in 1960, right, when the, you know, kind of around the time when the, you know, the lunch counter sit-ins and Greensboro are happening and you know, the 60s civil rights movement just, you know, kicks off into high gear. And Atticus Finch is the main character in that book, and he is, you know, famous in the, you know, in his town, his little Alabama town, and he will become famous in popular culture for, in the book, defending this wrongfully accused black man, Tom Robinson, defending him from a rape charge, from raping a white girl by the name of Mayella Yule. And Atticus is unable to get Tom off of the charge. Okay, so Tom is sent to prison. Tom is shot while he runs for defense in a possible, you know, kind of suicide. It's not exactly clear what happened. But the Atticus Finch character is the reformed Southerner, or at the very least, a reforming Southerner. This is a guy who, at worst, is a moderate on racial matters. In the book, he's, as Joe Crispino has argued in his recent book about Atticus Finch, in the book, he's more of a moderate. In the film, he's more of a liberal. You know, so there, I don't want to, you know, kind of get too bogged down in the details, but in a sense, he's a good Southerner. Okay, he's a good white Southerner. He is, if there's enough folks like him who follow his example, the South can find its way out of its racial dilemma. And they're kind of the most extreme version of the Changing South narrative is advanced by people like, you know, Walker Percy, the famed novelist from the South, who, you know, makes the case that, you know, it's possible that the South even will have lessons for the nation to teach, or will have lessons for the nation to learn regarding the issue of race, which is kind of a remarkable statement for a white Southerner to be making in 1965, you know. So that's the Changing South, the South on the mend. And then you have, finally, the third version of the white South, and that's the down-home South. This is the South of the Beverly Hillbillies and the South of the Andy Griffith Show, the town of Mayberry. Okay, so this is a South that plays out a lot on television sitcoms. And so in the book, I describe in particular those two programs, which, you know, spend a good amount of time, you know, with some kind of good-natured ribbing at the expense of their characters. But it is a show that time and time again makes the argument that the rural or small town values of the white Southerners on these shows is superior to the kind of modernistic, technocratic, acquisitive spirit of otherwise, you know, everyday Americans. Okay, so kind of the classic treatment of this on the Andy Griffith Show comes in an episode, 1963 episode called "Man in a Hurry." And in "Man in a Hurry," you have a gentleman from Charlotte. Okay, so he's a Southerner, but he, you know, he's from the big city. You know, so essentially he's been Northernized because he lives in this big urban center. And he comes to Mayberry and his car breaks down and he's just trying to get out of there, you know, and get his, you know, and get his car fixed as quickly as possible. And he gets so frustrated because of the Mayberryans, you know, they live this very slow pace of life and, you know, they're just dragging the process out and he just cannot wait to get out of there and he's getting so frustrated. And, you know, he learns, you know, over the course of the episode to slow down and kind of relax and enjoy, you know, enjoy the rhythms of small town Southern life and to really kind of recognize in some ways the superiority of that way of life. And so he falls asleep at the end of the episode, having, you know, just spent, you know, time, you know, just whittling and peeling an apple, you know. So he's gotten in touch with the kind of the small town Southern spirit. And so the down home South is an intensely positive version of Southernness and a white Southernness. And it's, you know, very much opposed to the vicious South narrative. So it's not even saying that Southerners need to change. It's saying that white Southerners are good as they are. And in fact, in many ways, their values are superior to those of non-Southerners and those who are, you know, so focused on kind of the everyday needs of the workaday modern world.
Now, in your second chapter, we get to move into some interesting material. And this was one I enjoyed a lot because I like country rock a fair bit. But this is how counterculture and the rest of America is now looking at the South. And superficially, it's this sort of improbable meeting, though, you know, you complicate that somewhat. What's going on there?
It is in some ways an improbable meeting, and so I'm interested in the countercultural perception, the hippie perception of white Southernness, and so I'm using music as a way to try to get at that. Now, there's a lot of refractions, I guess would be the right word, going on here. So it's not as if hippies are, you know, encountering white Southerners directly so much. Rather, they're encountering it through their music, but it's not, you know, the music that's traditionally associated with the white South being country music exactly. Although there are a lot of, you know, hippies who are, you know, really into Johnny Cash and really into, you know, even Merle Haggard, despite, you know, Okie from Muskogee, or sometimes maybe in because of it, if they think that you know, Haggard's kind of in on the joke or something, but which I think he probably was to a large extent. But be that as it may, they're actually encountering it largely through kind of a hippie version of country music, which is country rock. Okay, so country rock is difficult to define. You know, it has all kinds of different meanings as I lay out in the chapter. But basically, it's long haired musicians, mostly from a rock and roll background, playing country music. And so in the 1960s, you get a whole bunch of groups who are doing this. You know, you have the folk rock group, very popular folk rock group, the Byrds. You know, they start to play country music, or in fact, they kind of devote whole albums to country music. They had dabbled in country music for a number of years, actually. Bob Dylan famously will go to Nashville in 1966 and record tracks for Blonde on Blonde, which is not a country or a country rock album. But the album that he records in 1969 called Nashville Skyline very much is a low-key, very twangy country album. You know, very low stakes. You know, he's not singing about, you know, themes of war, and you know, he's not you know, doing blown in the Wind or Masters of War on that. I mean, he's singing you know, very low key tracks like I Threw It All Away. You know, great, good music, but just, you know, not the kind of stakes that he was creating, I think, in some of his earlier folk and folk rock recordings. I mean, in some ways, you know, the countercultural interest in country music is not as surprising as it may seem at first glance, because after all, these were people who, you know, had been and probably still were to some extent into folk music. You know, they liked blues, maybe they liked blues rock more, but they liked blues music. And so it just kind of made sense that they would kind of complete the musical triumvirate of Southern roots music and just add flat out country music into that equation. And it's a very specific version of country music. It's not the Nashville sound, which is a highly orchestrated, very poppy version of country music that's created in the 1960s by people like Chet Atkins in Nashville as a way to appeal to a larger swath of Americans than, you know, the kind of the what the scholar Richard Pearson would describe as like hardcore country music. You know, that's like Merle Haggard, that's Hank Williams, you know, that's you know, Johnny Cash, you know, guys who aren't putting strings on their albums, not making them syrupy. You know, they're tough. You know, it's tough music. You know, even like you know, Loretta Lynn. I mean, she would fall largely into that kind of hardcore category. So it's not all just men. But they're drawing on that music. They're also drawing on a version of Southern country music that's happening in Bakersfield, California, that's being performed by people like Merle Haggard and Buck Owens. Okay, so they're very inspired by that. So that's a further kind of, you know, kind of distancing from the kind of the Southern source of the music. And these country rockers are experimenting with the music. You know, if they're like Graham Parsons, they're adding, you know, kind of soul music into the mix. You know, at first I thought counterculturalists would just be very strict in what they would accept, you know, as authentic country music. You know, I thought they would make the argument, oh, well, it has to sound, you know, exactly like something that Hank Williams would have done in order for us to like it. And what I found is that their interests were a little bit more, you know, lowercase Catholic in that sense, and that they were actually wanting musicians to kind of put their own stamp on the music. Okay, so not just to kind of do a carbon copy version. In fact, there was one criticism of the 1968 album, the Byrds album, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and one countercultural reviewer criticized it for its academicness. You know, it was like a school project rather than, you know, like an authentic, you know, kind of lived in experience. But regardless of how, you know, hippies or their desires for how the music should sound, they really did look upon this music as a kind of a window into white Southern culture. You know, the counterculturalists were, you know, deeply concerned about the state of modern America. You know, they were, you know, not anti-technology per se, but they were concerned that technology had gotten in the way of the ability of people to just relate to one another, you know, to get to know each other, to connect with each other on a human level. And, you know, they also embraced music as a way to kind of just kind of get beyond the what they considered the over-reliance on rationality. Mm. You know, so people like Jerry Rubin or Abbie Hoffman would say, you know, it's a kind of rational thinking, that kind of technocratic thinking that got us into the Vietnam War, right? So that's, you know, is that what we want more of? You know, not necessarily. So so music becomes kind of a way to get away from that. But this version, it's really just a version, though, of the South. It's an imagining of the South that hippies are looking to through the music. So I don't know that they really have any. I mean, there are some hippies I talk about who do want to try to form connections with the perceived enemy, you know, of white Southerners in particular, or working class whites more broadly, who are increasingly part of the country music audience by the end of the 1960s. But I think a lot of them are kind of like Robbie Robertson. Robbie Robertson was, you know, was the principal songwriter of The Band, group of mostly Canadians in one Arkansan, who you know, came out with an album called The Band in 1969. That was not entirely, but worked somewhat as a concept album about the South. And it presented the South in, you know, very positive terms, presented a lost cause narrative even on the night they drove old Dixie down. And I think Robertson was fascinated by white Southerners. He considered them, you know, very strong, very persevering individuals, you know. And he created a music that, you know, that showcased them in very positive terms, even when they were enduring considerable struggles, which he did write about their struggles as well. But this was somebody, Robbie Robertson, who said, you know, I like to think essentially about when I'm writing this kind of music about white Southerners, I like to think about a lone, you know, shack, you know, kind of out in the distance, out in the field somewhere, you know, and he says something like, you know, I don't necessarily want to go up to the shack and knock on the door, you know, but I just want to kind of imagine it, you know? So it's like, he has this investment in an idea of the South. And then, you know, there's not necessarily a great inclination to really discover the reality of it. And I think that's a theme of a lot of people, a lot of Americans who are imagining the white South in the 60s and 70s and, you know, in other times as well. They don't really want to get to know the South. They want to use the South for whatever, I mean, in some ways, selfish purpose they desire it for. So hippies, the investment in the South and their version of the white South may seem odd at first, but the values that they ascribe to the white South, you know, traditionalism, okay, kind of an anti-modernity, you know, kind of a close familial spirit. You know, their embrace of that version of the South makes sense because it provides them with further tools in their fight against, you know, mainstream modern American society.
And to what extent are some of those, especially sort of anti-urban country living nostalgia themes, sort of an ongoing phenomenon in American life? You know, I was reading this and I was struck by the similarities. I mean, a lot of the themes are ones that get brought up in Jimmy Rogers' music in the late 20s and early 30s, you know, the sinful nature of country living and wanting to go back to the farm and go back and see mother. You know, there's so many Southern songs about all going back to see, you know, your elderly mother. Are there continuities there?
There definitely are. There definitely are. And you know, I make the case in the introduction too, you know, these are in many ways continuations on some of these earlier imaginings. So yeah, Jimmy Rogers is a great example. I also talk about, you know, the Nashville Agrarians, who in the 1930s write this book called, you know, I'll Take My Stand. And it's a stand against what they consider industrialism, you know, kind of modernity. And so they see the South as beginning to undergo a transformation to become more modernized, economically speaking, and in some ways socially, and they reject it. And they say, you know, the core of the South, and again, they're like kind of people, you know, I guess really prior to the 1970s, when they say the South, they refer to Southerners, they're talking about the white South. And they say, you know, the kind of the core of the South is an agrarian lifestyle. It's where all of the best of the South emerges from. It's the source of Southern virtue. Okay. And so to destroy that is to destroy the true essence of everything that is good about the South. So that's obviously, you know, playing out in the 1960s and 70s as well. I mean, not to oversimplify, but almost any positive imagining throughout American history of the South and white Southerners in particular, in some ways is deployed in service of a critique of some aspect of modernism or modernity, you know. So that's kind of a through line. I think what's going on that's different in the 1960s and why I think it's an interesting moment to kind of check in on these imaginings of the South is, you know, just the fact that the racial order, not just in the South, but in the nation is just so much in flux. And, you know, I think because there is a somewhat of a viable argument to be made that the South is undergoing racial reform, you know, one of the major drawbacks to, if you were somewhat of a, you know, fair, somewhat racially liberal perspective or racially moderate perspective of the nation, one of the real sticking points that would have prevented you from just kind of wholeheartedly embracing aspects of Southern culture is just the racist you know, the racist aspects of that culture. Well, now when it seemed that, you know, maybe the South was on the mend, or when Americans became kind of confronted, Americans outside of the South became increasingly confronted with their own racial problems. You know, once Watts happens in 65, the Watts riots, once a series of race riots break out in the late 1960s, I mean, clearly, as scholars have recently shown, I mean, there were, you know, myriad racial problems. There were movements for civil rights throughout the North, you know, well before this era. But the way it's reported at the time, it's as if, ooh, Northerners, white Northerners are all of a sudden, you know, discovering they've got these racial problems. I think that kind of takes a lot of the heat off of the South, off of the white South. And it opens it up to make it more of a candidate for a, you know, a more wholehearted embrace. So that's a big difference. Also, another thing that's interesting about the South during this period is that it is becoming increasingly integrated into the nation, both economically and politically. But at the same time, as the South is perceived to becoming more like the rest of America, it's still seen as somehow culturally distinct. So even though you have that kind of that almost constant drumbeat of a concern about, oh, is the South, is it losing its distinctiveness? You know, in an imagined sense, you know, Americans still, you know, considering the South just as strong of a cultural construct as ever, even though kind of all, you know, some of the other key trends politically and economically would suggest that the South is losing its distinctiveness as a cultural thing, though, as something that's you know, somehow culturally separate from the rest of the nation. It very much seems to be, you know, kind of hanging on to that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's why the 60s and the 70s is important to talk about, that these imaginings, even if they do have, you know, some similarities between earlier ones and later ones, because it is such a moment of transition, not only in America at large, but within the South itself.
Now, your third chapter, and we've talked a lot about race up until now, but your third chapter takes it in sort of a different direction, and this is much more aimed at masculinity. And it picks one real life figure and one semi fictional. You look at George Wallace, and then the movie Walking Tall. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So I look at this version of the South that I call the masculine South. So it's kind of a, you know, it's in some ways it functions as kind of a separate, you know, narrative about the South. In some ways, it's kind of a subset, at least as George Wallace uses it, it's kind of a subset of the vicious South. So, you know, I've talked mainly about how the vicious South is, you know, a version of the region, which, you know, Americans largely from outside of the region, you know, look negatively upon the South as just kind of, you know, this racist wasteland that just a bunch of violent people and we want to have, you know, nothing to do with them. Okay. Well, Wallace kind of turns that on its head. You know, Wallace running as a segregationist in 1968 for the presidency. Yeah. I mean, he's obviously not shying away from his own racism or from the racism of the region in which he hails from. But he says, you know, that's a positive thing, you know? So he will look at, you know, the race riots that are happening in American society in the late 1960s. And, you know, he'll say to a packed audience at Madison Square Garden during the 68 campaign, we know how to handle race relations in the South. So if somebody gets out of hand, if somebody tries to riot, you know, and when he says somebody or he says they, you know, he's talking about African-Americans. It's clear to his audience. It's clear to everybody, even though he doesn't use the term. But he says when somebody gets out of hand, you know, and they pick up a brick, you know, what do you do? Well, and I'm paraphrasing somewhat, but he says, you know, you put a bullet in their brain and then you ask the next one, all right, go ahead, pick up a brick, you know? So there is this kind of viciousness, you know, to this image of the South as the masculine South. I start out this chapter to kind of give you a little bit more background. I start out this chapter with a discussion of Lester Bangs. Okay, and Lester Bangs is a you know kind of famed, you know, journalist, the you know admired by hipsters around the world, you know, as like one of the great, you know, kind of rock journalists of the 1970s. And Lester Bangs was sitting in a bar in Macon, Georgia, in I guess in the mid 1970s, and he overheard one of the bar patrons say this phrase. It's one of these Southern patrons, and he said this phrase, you know, seemed to encapsulate, according to Bangs, you know, kind of the attitude of the South. And the phrase was, "When in doubt, kick ass." Okay, and so I use this phrase, "When in doubt, kick ass," to discuss the masculine South, because essentially that's what Wallace is all about. He's about a politics of racial backlash that is about literally kicking the asses of not just. And it's not just about race. It's not just about, you know, beating down black protesters or African Americans engaged in urban uprisings. It's about, you know, beating back, you know, the demands of feminists in the late 60s, early 70s. About, you know, beating back the demands of anti-war protesters. Okay, and so Wallace is somebody who describes himself as a professional Southerner. You know, and I never quite fully grasped like what he means by that. But what it means to me is that he is just somebody who, you know, he is inseparable. His Southernness is inseparable from him, you know, so that any kind of solutions that Wallace proposes, they all kind of stem from his own experience as a Southerner. Okay. So he constantly talks about, you know, how do you keep, you know, America, you know, in protesters, you know, in check, you know, how do we prevent America from getting out of control, or it's already out of control, he would say, how do we get it back under control? And, you know, he proposes largely that we use violence, and he constantly invokes, you know, how we do things down South, you know, we beat up protesters, we shoot them, you know, if necessary, that's how we do things in the South. You know, he says, if we really want to solve the problems in this country, you know, all we got to do is just, you know, kind of, you know, set loose a bunch of Birmingham steel workers with about a 10th grade education on the problem. You know, they won't be so genteel, he says, you know, when dealing with racial disturbances. Right. So, yeah. So the violence that Wallace proposes as the solution for the unrest in late 60s, early 70s America, it's a kind of a Southern, what he would identify as kind of a Southern style approach. Now, along with that, you have a film that comes out in 1973 called Walking Tall. And it's a low budget film. It is, it does very well on the drive-in circuit. Okay. But it's a very profitable movie. And so the popular culture that I've chosen for the book, I mean, it's not obscure stuff. You know, it's things that a lot of Americans would have seen that was, you know, widely reviewed, and understood to be somehow important to the culture at the time. Now, on the face of it, Walking Tall, which is a fictionalized account of, or I guess, you know, kind of, I guess the way to put it, it's a based upon a true story account of this guy named Buford Pusser, who was a sheriff in the county of McNary in Tennessee in the 1960s. And Buford Pusser was a former wrestler known as Buford the Bull. And he comes back home at the start of the film, and he goes back to work on his father's farm. So here he is, you know, kind of, you know, participating in the virtues of rural Southern living, okay, near a small town, okay, but this is not Mayberry that he lives next to, right? So this is a town that is ruled by vice lords, okay. So early in the film, he and a buddy go to this place called the Lucky Spot, which it will prove to be not so lucky for Buford, as he's beaten up there and he's left for dead on the side of the road. When he goes in the back room and engages in an illegal game of chance. So Pusser eventually is beaten up. He runs for sheriff and he sets upon to root out vice. Okay. To get rid of, you know, the prostitution, the, you know, illegal gambling, you know, everything that has come to this town. All right. So, you know, Buford Pusser, the character, is in many ways kind of Wallace-like. You know, he criticizes judges, you know, who seem too caught up on the intricacies of the law, you know, who seemingly want to are more interested in protecting the rights of criminals than they are in protecting, you know, the lives of the innocent who might be hurt by these criminals. And so, you know, he's very outspoken. He does things that you wouldn't, you know, expect law enforcement to do or think that they maybe should do. You know, for example, there's a cop that's been, you know, I guess, you know, kind of in some ways kind of collaborating or, you know, letting the vice lords kind of have their way. Well, Buford Pusser, you know, threatens to dynamite that cop, okay, rather than if he doesn't give him some vital information. So he seems very Wallace-like in the sense that, you know, he's willing to do whatever it takes, whether or not civil liberties are being violated in order to accomplish it. But what's very different from Wallace is that Pusser, he's a tough guy, okay, he's all about kicking ass, but he's a, relatively speaking, he's racially egalitarian. Okay, so he has a black deputy who he treats with dignity. Okay, but still, he kind of there's an element of racial paternalism within that relationship. Okay, but you wouldn't call him a racist in the way that you would George Wallace. Okay, so that's kind of that masculine South toughness. The South as the white South in particular, as this idea or this kind of place in the mind in which Americans can go if they're feeling like, oh, you know, society, it's kind of being sapped of its vigor. It's being sapped of its manliness. You know, there's all these publications in the 1970s that suggest that, you know, American masculinity is waning. Okay. It's the era of the kind of the androgynous, you know, singer-songwriter, Jackson Brown and, you know, Neil Young. And so the South says, no, we're going to pump virility. We're going to pump masculinity back into the American spirit. And so the South seems to be a place, at least in, you know, the rhetoric and the campaigns of Wallace and in films like Walking Tall that suggests that, masculinity is there for the taking, is there for the tapping.
Now in your fourth chapter, you actually sort of you go back to music, but this time you're looking at Southern rock. Now, how do you construct that as distinct from country rock, and how are people using Southern rock to imagine the South?
Yeah, Southern rock is different. I would define it as music that is played, first of all, by Southerners. So Southern rockers are actually people from the South. Now, that's not to say that there weren't some country rockers like a Graham Parsons, you know, who had their origins in the South. But some one's own Southern identity is really central to Southern rock music. Okay, so you self-identify as somebody who is from the South, and in some ways, I think those musicians feel that they are representing the South through that music. So I think the kind of the stakes of identity are higher in Southern rock music. Also, the sound of the music is different. Although, you know, bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd and, you know, and the Allman Brothers, who I focus on in that chapter, do definitely draw on country music to varying degrees. The basis of the Southern rock sound is really rhythm and blues music, but even more so, I would say the influence is British blues rock, you know. So the Allman Brothers Band really is, for much of its early recording career, I mean, basically a blues band. You know, they're performing covers of Muddy Waters and Elmore James and doing their own original kind of takes on kind of the black post-war Southern blues sound. Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, their biggest musical influence, and this is not going to be like a big one for most of us, but is the band Free, like Paul Rogers' band before he did Bad Company, you know, and that, so that's like this kind of very, you know, kind of, you know, loud and, you know, kind of, you know, bluesy rock and roll band. I think the influences are a little bit different as well. And so the sound is just, it's a little bit more aggressive. it I mean, it sounds more like rock and roll, whereas country rock sounds more like country music. You know, Greg Allman would say, you know, I don't really understand like Southern rock. I mean, I thought, you know, basically, you know, it's like calling it rock. You know, rock music is from the South, so it seems like a redundancy is what he was getting at. And in some ways he was right. But this kind of combination of British blues, rhythm and blues, and a little dash of country music, that's what makes the Southern rock sound. So, you know, if you want to, I mean, you know, a good you know, version of that is Lynyrd Skynyrd's Gimme Three Steps. You know, it's like, well, what kind of music are they drawing on? Well, it's kind of bluesy and it's kind of country-ish. You know, there's some R&B in there too. So it's just kind of like a putting all that into a blender and mixing it up. And what comes out is this very distinctive, very almost kind of paradoxically loose and tight at the same time. So those bands, you know, in particular, there's many Southern rock bands, you know, in the constellation of Southern rock bands. But I think the two most important ones are clearly the Allman Brothers Band and Lynyrd Skynyrd. They're also the two most commercially successful ones. Now, the Allman Brothers Band are presenting their southernness. It's what I would describe as a countercultural southernness. So they are, you know, they kind of come off as hippies. You know, they're long hairs. They early in their career, they live in a communal environment. You know, it's like they live in a commune, basically, in Macon. And, you know, they buy a farm later on, which they call the farm. And, you know, they hang out there and they take kind of a lot of spiritual sustenance, you know, from small town and rural settings as well. So this music that they play is, and I would say that the general kind of spirit that they convey is one of togetherness, you know, is this kind of countercultural spirit. And they're also very racially progressive. So they have a black man in the band from the beginning. Okay. They have a black drummer. Later they will have a black bassist. So it's an integrated band, which is very unusual, you know, for a rock band. And you can say, okay, well, the Stax studio band, okay, Booker T and the MGs, that's an integrated band, but that's a kind of a different kind of music, you know? So a rock, but a straight up kind of rock and roll band, you know, to be integrated at that time and to importantly to come from the South, that's a very significant thing, because this is still in the late 1960s when this is happening. So I think the Allman Brothers, they kind of present for a lot of listeners the best of the South, the best of the white South, what it can be. You know, they're drawing on that kind of changing South attitude. They're also drawing upon that down home South attitude that places a lot of value in rural and small town Southern life. And then on the other side, you have Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, which seems to be a very different group, because Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, really kind of takes that notion of white Southern pride and just, you know, kind of amps it up on steroids, really. You know, they are proud Southerners. They're unapologetic Southerners. I mean, this is a band, after all, that would really throughout its career, into the last year of the life of the initial band before a tragic plane crash would claim the lives of some of its members, and the band would then kind of fold temporarily. They would fly the Confederate flag, really the Confederate battle flag is what they were flying, and they would come out on stage to an orchestrated version of Dixie. You know, they use the Confederate flag in their in the different you know, kind of merchandise that they sold. I think their mascot was you know, like a skull smoking a cigar, wearing a Stetson with a Confederate flag neckerchief. You know, so it kind of gives you an idea of what they were going after. But so yeah, so it's all about unapologetic masculinity. It's you know, people have very, you know, differing impressions over what Skynyrd was, or what their lead singer Ronnie Van Zant, what his real politics were. There's some effort to try to kind of make Ronnie Van Zant into some kind of you know, kind of closeted liberal, you know. But I think in many ways they were consciously or sometimes unconsciously, perhaps, you know, presenting kind of a neo-Confederate, worldview, in part through their use of the flag, in part through their kind of sometimes mealy-mouthed embrace of George Wallace. You know, sometimes they said, oh, well, you know, I really don't like George Wallace because of what he says, quote, about yeah. colored people. It's what they said once. But I like the fact that he has balls, you know, so that, there you go. There's the masculine South again. So it's like they're kind of speaking out of both sides of their mouth about it. Now, they weren't just like coming out and just unprompted and saying, I love George Wallace, you know, but George Wallace, being the politician that he did, or I think somebody on his staff said, hey, there's this very popular rock band that has this song about Alabama. And he was talking about the Skinner's smash hit Sweet Home Alabama. And hey, wouldn't it be a good idea to kind of try to, you know, get on that train a little bit. And so Wallace in the mid 70s as governor of Alabama made the members of the band honorary lieutenant colonels in the, I believe, the Alabama State Militia. But this is an honor that they accepted. And this is an honor that I spoke about with the guitarist Ed King, the Skinner guitarist Ed King, you know, many years, of course, after the honor was bestowed on him. And, you know, he said that was something that they were proud of, and that he and the other members of the band liked Wallace because he was somebody who stood up for the average white guy in the South. And that, you know, and the idea was that they felt that that was somebody who needed standing up for, because they were in many ways kind of average white guys, you know, if you want to say that. They were working class white men. And I think that they felt kind of beleaguered, and to some extent, understandably so, as a result of all this kind of vicious South rhetoric during the 60s. But, you know, but this version of Southerness that they embrace, it does have some kind of uncomfortable parallels with earlier, you know, white Southerners saying like, hey, leave us alone, like, let us take care of matters on our own. And that, you know, maybe seemed to apply to matters relating to race. It wasn't quite clear. So in short, the Allman Brothers Band are kind of like the peace and love, you know, Southern rockers, and Skinner are kind of the, you know, kind of kick you in the teeth, you know, stomp on your neck after you've fallen down kind of Southern rockers. But they're all, I would argue, kind of united by this kind of, I think, general kind of discomfort with the state of American masculinity and the desire for, you know, men to be allowed to be men. So in many respects, even though they're very different in the way they express their Southerness, they're expressing it in the midst of a concern about, the feminization of American society and culture. And I think they see themselves, you know, not necessarily consciously, but they see themselves as part of a resistance to that feminization.
And then you end the book in your fifth chapter looking at the election of Jimmy Carter in 1976, which, this is presenting a whole new face on the South. How does Carter manage that? And you also spend some time on Ford. How does Ford try to approach that?
I mean, it's tough for Carter. And I think in some ways the Carter campaign struggles with exactly how to position Carter as a Southerner, because they can't shy away from that. It's you know, it's not like, you know, even Bill Clinton in 1992 couldn't escape, you know, the fact that he was, you know, in from Arkansas. And certainly in 1976, you know, Jimmy Carter couldn't do that. So I think he, you know, they're very savvy about it. And so they settle on kind of three aspects of the candidate Carter's Southerness that they want to promote. And in an old but great, I still think, biography of Carter and his 76 campaign, called Jimmy Carter in Search of the Great White House, Betty Glad, the late political scientist, I think former reporter, she argues that basically the Carter campaign that really broke down his Southerness into kind of three categories. It was region, it was race, and it was religion. Okay, so the region thing is, you know, hey, Jimmy Carter comes from, you know, he's a son of the rural South, like, legitimately, like, he grows up in southern Georgia. He grows up in a little settlement on the outskirts of Plains, Georgia, called Archery. And his father is, you know, I mean, he's not a Rockefeller, you know, but he's the family is much better off than the black sharecroppers who you know work for Mr. Carter, for Jimmy Carter's father. And so, you know, it's a kind of, as Jimmy Carter presents it during the campaign, it's kind of a bucolic upbringing. You know, he says in his campaign biography, Why Not the Best? He says, you know, our life on the, I'm paraphrasing some of it, but he says, you know, our life on the farm, you know, was much closer to, during the 30s, was much closer to the farm life of 2,000 years ago than it is to the farm life of today, you know, meaning 1975 when the book comes out. And it's kind of a remarkable statement, a little bit hyperbolic, but Carter is clearly trying to position himself as a Southerner who is, you know, who knows the land, who grew up on the land, who, you know, is closely connected to his family, and that somehow, you know, makes him, you know, capable of being uncorrupted by, you know, various aspects of modern urban American life. And he uses his family a lot on the campaign trail to try to help him out. You know, his mother, you know, Lillian is just like the kind of the stereotype of like kind of the sassy, like Southern matriarch. You know, she's strong, she's assertive. It's also helpful that she has a long history of, you know, racial egalitarianism. You know, he uses her to great effect on the campaign trail. Even his brother Billy, you know, who is kind of an embarrassment at sometimes in that he drinks a lot and he tells a lot of off-color jokes and not very often when there's reporters nearby willing to report on it. He is somebody who humanizes Jimmy, who kind of mitigates what the journalist Larry L. King would describe as Jimmy's official pieties, you know, makes him seem a little bit more approachable and accessible. And so that's the region part of Carter. He's authentic, right? Because he comes from this authentic, unaffected place, you know, the rural South, you know, the red soil of Southern Georgia. So then you've got Carter utilizing his religion. Okay. So this is, you know, it's not like, you know, no candidate for high office had ever talked about religion before, but the fact that the Carter is an evangelical Christian, that he's a Southern Baptist at a time when Americans are just kind of, I mean, certainly not evangelicals themselves, but a lot of non-evangelicals are kind of suddenly coming to the realization that, oh, there's like this group of people, like evangelical Christians, and like, what are they all about? And, you know, so it's a kind of a time of discovery of this important subgroup in American religious life. And Carter is one of them. And Carter is somebody who the Ford campaign describes as wearing his religion on his sleeve. And, you know, Carter, some say he exploits his religion, you know, for political effect, for political benefit. Others just, I think most voters, though, at least according to the polling, they see it as an authentic representation of his views. And it's obviously, it's a religion. It's a Southern Baptist religion. It stems from the South. He's a lifelong Christian. He had a very famously a born again kind of experience in the mid 60s after he lost a very important gubernatorial election. And so it helps to humanize Carter. He uses it to as kind of the center of his campaign, which is in very, very many, in many ways based on kind of morality. You know, he's the anti-Watergate candidate. You know, he says, I'll never lie to the American people. I'm going to restore dignity to the office of the presidency. Okay. So that, and there is a sense that Americans are picking up on this. So for those candidates, or for, excuse me, for those Americans who are concerned about the spiritual moral state of the nation, Time magazine would find in a poll that that most of them supported Carter. Okay, so clearly that message is being received loud and clear. And then finally, just briefly, I mean the race angle. I mean, Carter is somebody who credibly can, you know, be viewed at worst as a moderate on race during the 1960s, and by the early 70s, he's clearly a racial liberal. Okay, he says very famously, after running kind of a race-baiting Wallace-esque campaign, he says in 1971 during his inaugural address as governor of Georgia, you know, the time for racial discrimination is over. Okay, and a lot of the voters, a lot of his supporters felt kind of betrayed, you know, because it's like, wow, that's not the candidate that I thought I was electing. But you know, he comes into office, he puts, you know, puts up in the state house, I think, you know, a portrait of Martin Luther King. He hires a lot of African Americans to state offices, and you know, he comes off as a racial healer, and so it's kind of ironic that a white Southerner, you know, runs on. You know, runs on a platform of being a racial healer. But Carter is again kind of invoking this changing South idea, you know, or maybe it's the changed South by that point. You know, I'm somebody who has lived through the very trying experiences of civil rights. You know, I've changed. We've all changed in the South, blacks and whites. You know, we've had a racial reckoning, and we've come to something of a reconciliation. And I think that I have something that can be helpful to the rest of the nation. You know, newspapers report that, you know, perhaps, you know, Carter's thinking here along the lines of the current, you know, Boston busing crisis. You know, Southerners can, you know, maybe they have a thing or two to teach, you know, white Northerners about how to resolve these tough racial situations. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous argument. I mean, in reality, but you know, but it is seen as credible by a lot of commentators, and I think by a lot of voters. So Carter is in many ways is like the pinnacle of these imaginings of the South. He's bringing it all together, right? He's bringing kind of the racial change component. He's coupling that with you know, the rural small town authentic aspect, and then he's adding something kind of fresh to the equation, which is his religiosity and just the depth of his religiosity. I mean, you asked like, how does the Ford campaign respond to this? I think the Ford campaign is just really kind of at a loss. You know, I mean, to get advice on how to deal with Jimmy Carter's Southernness, kind of Ford's inner circle asks Betty Ford's speechwriter, who just happens to be from Tennessee. Okay, this woman who's not part of the Gerald Ford presidential campaign, and she actually, she comes up with actually a very very knowledgeable, very insightful memo in which she tells the Ford campaign, well, you know, listen, I mean, Jimmy Carter, part of what his power is based in is the idea that, you know, he's fusing together kind of two seemingly paradoxical ideas, kind of the black and white together South, as she terms it, and then the, you know, the good old boy rural South. You know, somehow he's able to combine these two things, and it's become a very powerful, you know, combination. She argues, she thinks it's kind of BS, you know, but in reality, but she says that, you know, commentators in particular are just kind of reporting on it as if that's the truth of the matter. So the Ford campaign is in a tricky spot because they're concerned that trying to peel off white Southern voters from Carter's camp will be in some ways construed as attacking Carter's Southernness. So the Ford campaign does something interesting, but in some ways kind of expected, which is to make the argument to white Southern voters that Jimmy Carter is, yeah, he's Southern. Okay, we acknowledge that. We acknowledge that you may be inclined to vote for him because you are Southern as well. Okay, so they acknowledge kind of a Southern chauvinism, even though they don't use that term, of course. But they say, you know, but Jimmy Carter, you know, he's not really, you know, much of a Southerner when it comes to his values and it comes to his political positions. So in an ad campaign that features the South Carolina senator and former Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond, Thurmond will say, you know, the only thing Southern about Jimmy Carter is his accent. You know, when it comes to the issues, you know, that's about it. You know, he's a liberal. You know, he's a far left liberal, right? So the Ford campaign just tries to say, you know, vote. vote not for the region, but vote for the policies, right? And of course, they're constructing white Southernness in terms of conservatism. You know, to be white and to be Southern is to be a political conservative. You know, so that they struggle to kind of come up with a viable strategy, and they are not able to fully overcome the appeal of Jimmy Carter to white Southerners that is based just in his region. You know, the fact that he is one of them. But I also argue that I don't think you can just say a kind of an empty-headed Southern chauvinism is the only reason that white Southerners do vote in increasing numbers for Carter. Certainly, you know, and more white Southerners voted for Carter than had McGovern and allowed him to win, you know, every Southern state except Georgia. I think it also has to do with the fact that they like the way that he presents the South. You know, he presents the South in a very positive way. You know, those kind of the three categories that place Southerners and white Southerners in a very positive light. Now, it is important to note that a slight, you know, plurality of white Southerners do end up voting for Ford. And so it's really the African-American vote in the South that enables Carter to, you know, to eke out a victory in a lot of these states. But even that is kind of an amazing, you know, story of a white Southerner convincing African Americans that here's a guy that not only will I not be racist, but I will pursue policies that will be, you know, beneficial to you. And it's like a Harlem resident said during the campaign, you know, I respect a good Southern white man because he's not a hypocrite. You know, so it's like if the white Southerner is espousing kind of racially progressive policies, he's really got to mean it, you know, because to come from that position or to arrive at that position in the 1960s and early 1970s South, like that guy probably took a lot of heat. And so there's a lot of respect for Carter by African Americans, not just in the South, but throughout the nation, that allow him to, you know, to get a lot of support. And of course, just real quick, you know, it's obviously not just white Southerners who like Carter's Southernness. A lot of people from outside the South will identify with Carter's so-called Southern values as just kind of what the doctor ordered in terms of, you know, dealing with the so-called moral or spiritual or political decline post Watergate of America. But maybe this guy, maybe he's a kind of a pure individual, and maybe that purity comes out of his rural, racially progressive, you know, religiously committed Southernness. So yeah, so Carter brings it all together, and I just don't think the Ford campaign really had much of a chance to successfully undermine that without shooting themselves in the foot.
One question I always like to ask at the end of these: what are you thinking of working on next?
Well, it's good that we're, noteworthy that we're ending on Carter, because I'm considering a project, thinking hard about another project that continues with Carter. So really looking at Jimmy Carter as an icon, looking at his imagery during the 1970s in particular, and thinking about the way that Carter, you know, his image, his contradictions embody, you know, many of the concerns of Americans during the 1970s. So in a sense, kind of using Carter as a window into 1970s America and the transitions that are occurring in 1970s America. So, you know, thinking about, you know, the move to, you know, kind of a colorblind kind of racial, you know, politics, you know, thinking about, certainly, you know, the transformation of the South economically, politically, culturally during this era. Thinking about, you know, the turn toward more of a human rights focus, but at the same time, you know, kind of a re-amping up of the Cold War toward the end of Carter's term. You know, so just you know, seeing Carter, or looking at Carter as a window into, you know, just the Americans kind of coming to terms with the transitions and the kind of fears of decline during the 1970s. So it's not a project that's going to argue that Al Carter was somehow a secret success as a president, although I think he did have some successes. It's not really interested in that. It's similar to this project in the sense that it uses Southernness, it uses a Southern figure to try to kind of tell a larger story about what's going on in America during the 1970s in particular, but also beyond, because I think in many respects, Carter is, we don't typically think of the age of Carter, right? We think of, the age of Roosevelt, and we think of the age of Reagan, or maybe even if you're Gil Troy, thinking about the age of Clinton. But I think that much of Carter's rhetoric and his kind of the imagery associated with him, for example, the idea of the outsider, kind of coming into Washington and, kind of shaking things up. Not entirely a new idea, but the idea that somehow like political inexperience is at the national level is somehow a positive and not a negative. I think we can kind of see in today's culture, we can see the continued relevance of the danger of a thought like that. So looking at Carter as not just a window into the 1970s, but in some ways looking at Carter as a window into some of the political and the cultural transitions that are beginning in the 1970s, but that continue on well into the period that we would typically associate with the age of Reagan. So the age of Carter, if we want to term it that, is kind of an overlapping period. So yeah, just obviously in the kind of the early stages of kind of thinking about that, but I think that's the next Fabulous. Kind of the next direction.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us
today. I'm looking to pursue. Thank you, Zeb. I appreciate your time. Yeah.